Go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! The merciful last day of February. You know, life being finite and human life being all too short, one should probably not celebrate the passage of time. But it's kind of hard not to note the joy that attends the close of this February, this brutally cold February. And it's gone, and or will be soon, and we're still here. And that's a good thing. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you go to find the chat room, which is filling up with our usual multimedia-enhancing gang of conversationalists. Good evening, Jan. Good evening, Lottie. Good evening, Sparky. Good evening, Waggy. More to come as the hour proceeds. Hours proceed. You'll also find our brand new shiny Listen Live button at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, as well as a selection of news stories for your consideration that we hope among us that we hope you will find interesting. And of course, at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, you will also find the PayPal button and the traditional mail address for those of you who wish to help keep this effort going from month to month, because that is how, hell, sometimes we exist from week to week, depending on how the bills are playing out. But please feel free to use it. We are going to try to raise $150 this evening. That will close out the month of February, because February is the shortest month, $500 short of where we need to be if we can raise the $150 this evening. So thank you very kindly in advance to those of you who do respond as such. This, of course, is Friday on the Front Porch. All of our Fridays, our Friday on the Front Porch, we will be joined, I presume, at some point by four members of the Horn Family Commune on the traditional telephone lines, because that's how many lines we can bring on at one time. There are actually six lines here, but we can only bring four on at one time. And we will also be joined by the Horn Molloy Skype chat group, which can hold a whole lot more people. If you've never participated in Friday in the Front Porch, I encourage you to. It is a rollicking, rousing, good time. And if you are at all conversant with Skype, I encourage you to do that. If you are not already hooked up as a friend O Sparky, send a contact request to SparkyDunk, SparkyDunc, at Skype. He'll see it, he'll approve it, and you can be part of the Horn Molloy Skype chat group that is an integral part of Friday on the Front Porch. If you can't, if the phone is how you have to reach us, well, that there's four phones there, four phone lines there for your use. We'll open up the Skype line in fairly short order, as well as the phone lines, and we'll get Friday on the Front Porch underway. Now, I admit it. I am glad to see this February close out. It's been cold, and now I'm so confused now as far as what to expect from the weather. I just don't know. We know that the, oh my God, 100 million people are going to be buried in 1 million feet of snow. BS was exactly that. It's BS, but nonetheless, there's a winter storm watch on for, I guess, starting Sunday and into Monday here in Appalachistan. Talking about freezing rain, sleet, ice, the very stuff you hate the most. But I don't think this is the same as the great big, oh my God, 100 million people are going to be buried in 100 feet of snow link bait prediction that we talked about a couple of nights ago on the program. No, I don't think that's that at all. So, just to catch up with a little bit of stuff that maybe got missed over the course of the passage of the week. And by the way, thank you, Ed. Thanks to Ed for getting us started on fundraising this evening. We now need only $125 to finish the night's fundraising, and it is easier to raise $125 than it is to raise $150. So, thank you very much, Ed. It is much appreciated. Some stuff that bears noting from earlier in the week, yesterday, day before yesterday, what have you. Some of these things you can find on my Facebook page if you are friended and following me there. I encourage you to do so. We're not making any money off the Facebook page. We don't make any money off following me on Twitter. No, this is not a commercial enterprise by any stretch of the imagination. It is not an attempt to make a profit. It is not an attempt. It is an attempt to keep the conversation going. But nonetheless, there are some stories that have passed our notice. One of which has to do with Duke Energy. You might remember Duke Energy. They're the giant electric coal-fired power outlet that supplies energy to North Carolina and I believe parts of maybe Virginia and South Carolina. And you might recall that shortly after the disaster that befell West Virginia, another disaster befell the Dan River in North Carolina, and it was, of course, brought about by Duke Energy, and it was tons and tons and tons, gallons and gallons and gallons of toxic, ultra-toxic coal waste that got dumped into the Dan River, which then runs downstream to communities in places like Danville, Virginia. Guess what? I know you're going to find this a little bit, well, probably a lot unsettling and maybe even infuriating. If you're like me, you're going to run straight past unsettled and just plop down in the easy chair at infuriated. We paid them to do that. We who, Bob? We the people. We, the people of the United States, trying to form that more perfect union. We paid Duke Energy to dump tons and tons and thousands and tens of thousands of tons of pressed down, shaken together, poisonous, toxic waste into the Dan River. Mm-hmm. It's not something that I say with any pride. But we are fact-based here, and there's just not a heck of a lot of getting around it. We did. We the people, via what we commonly refer to as corporate welfare, paid Duke Energy to dump all that poison in waters of the United States. What does that mean? Well, to be more precise, and this story comes from South Carolina and thestate.com. It is reprinted from the Charlotte Observer in an article by Rick Rothiker. Rick Rothiker writes, Charlotte-based Duke Energy is among 26 profitable Fortune 500 companies that didn't pay any federal income taxes from 2008 to 2012. Nice racket. Among all industries, gas and electric utility companies had the lowest effective rate at 2.9%. Wow, what's the effective rate of your taxes? Yeah, it's not 2.9%, is it? No. Benefiting from a tax break that comes from taking accelerated depreciation on the capital investments they make in their plants. You know, capital investments like making sure that your pipelines have structural integrity enough to keep from dumping tens of thousands of concentrated coal ash poison in certain rivers, like maybe the Dan River. They got a tax break for it. They just didn't do it. Duke said it will pay the federal taxes over the 30 to 40-year life of its projects. Hey, look. There went some more of the commons. Man, it just flows downstream. The car commons do, bobbing in and out of the ashbergs of arsenic, mercury, cadmium, barium, magnesium, aluminum, selenium, manganese, bearing, coal ash. Rick Rothiker continues and says, federal tax law, on paper, snicker, requires corporations to pay 35% of their profits in federal income taxes, but the groups found the actual rate was 19.4% after tax breaks and other deductions for the 288 companies covered by the report. A third of the companies paid less than 10%, Bob McIntyre, one of the authors of the report, told the Charlotte Observer. It says if you've got lobbying muscle, your return on investment is very high. They posted profits, Duke Energy did, of $9 billion, that's billion with a B, from 2008 to 2012, but they got tax rebates of $299 million. Duke spokesman Tom Williams said, by way of explaining the situation where his corporate masters pay pay next to nothing in income tax, said, Duke Energy, like all utilities, is a very capital-intensive business. Our federal taxes were lowered by bonus depreciation rules temporarily put in place as a part of the 2009 federal stimulus to help create jobs. The company recently completed a $9 billion plant modernization program in which it retired coal plants and replaced them with more efficient and cleaner natural gas and coal units, Williams said. Many of these projects were already planned and or started before the 2009 recession. However, while they did retire the coal plant that sits there hard up against the Dan River, they didn't manage to remember that they had a really, really significantly screwed up, great big humongous pipe that led out of their coal ash dam and into the Dan River, which broke. Which they didn't tell anybody about for a day or two. Because when it broke, they realized, well, holy cats, we have no idea of how to fix this. And so it just sat there, pumping poison, pumping poison, pumping poison, pumping poison. Because, you know, why would you want to? I mean, you're going to have to spend some of that capital. What will the shareholders say? That's what we ask ourselves. What would the shareholders say? Yeah, but what about the people you're poisoning? Are they shareholders? Well, no, mostly no. Well, then we don't care. Charming, isn't it? So, meanwhile, off in New Mexico, still having a hard time sorting out just exactly how many people have been poisoned with radiation. Al Jazeera with the story, and Nadine posted this to my Facebook page. Yeah, this kind of gives you the creepy crawlies to think about. Al Jazeera reports federal officials and a private contractor, gotta love them, held a joint press conference on Thursday, that would be yesterday, to say it is too soon to speculate about the health effects of a radiation leak at the nation's first underground nuclear waste repository. The Waste Isolation Pilot Project, WIP, is a project of the Department of Energy, who have then subcontracted out the management of the site. And it's in New Mexico, and they did confirm this past Wednesday that 13 workers who were above ground the night of a reported radiation leak have tested positive for radiation exposure. They say more workers are being tested. Uh-huh. Because the DOE said more tests are needed to determine the levels of exposure and emphasize that all readings at the site have been what they said were very low levels because, you know, sometimes radiation is good for you. Yeah, I'm guessing this isn't the good kind. This underground nuclear waste dump takes plutonium-contaminated waste, yes, plutonium, from nuclear bomb construction sites of 15 years gone. Air around the site has given off elevated radiation readings, but the officials have said that, well, you know, the readings are too low to constitute a public health threat. That must be that good plutonium radiation. It's interesting because none of this was supposed to happen. It never is, because the precautionary principle is something we ought to be using in this country, but aren't. The first question that gets asked should be, hey, is this safe? Can this safely be done in and around human beings? If it can't, maybe we shouldn't do it. No, we say, hey, we want to do this. Let's start doing it. What? People are getting radiated? Tell them it's the good kind. Yeah, Asa understands with a message. Now you're splitting hairs, Bob. What's a wee bit of americium and cesium among friends? Right. I mean, sure. Only her oncologist knows for sure. Right? Sure. And then this. You may recall we just had a discussion earlier, about a month or so ago? You may recall that the poorly named, ill-fated USS Ronald Reagan was sent in to provide relief after the Fukushima nuclear disaster. You may recall that some of the people who are now being regulated are now being represented, rather, by lawyers who are trying to recover from TEPCO under the claim that TEPCO openly and actively lied to people about how dangerous the Fukushima situation was. You may recall them talking about some of the now plaintiffs discussing how they went out and played on deck in the nuclear snow. A new report on the nuclear crisis that started to unfold in Fukushima, Japan, almost 3 years ago, suggests that American troops who assisted with disaster relief efforts were exposed to unheard-of radiation levels while on assignment. Kyle Cleveland, sociology professor at Temple University, Japan, makes a case for that argument in an academic paper published in the Asia-Pacific Journal this week, titled Mobilizing Nuclear Bias, the Fukushima Nuclear Crisis and the Politics of Uncertainty. Sounds like a little bit of light reading. Well, couple that with an article by Harvey Wasserman over at Huffington Post. Headline, and maybe the headline's enough. Headline: Documents show the Navy knew Fukushima dangerously contaminated the USS Reagan. Maybe we should decommission the Reagan, drag it out to the deepest part of the Pacific Ocean, having done everything possible to decontaminate it, and then sink it in the Marianas Trench. A fitting end for something named the USS Ronald Reagan. After all, his body should have been thrown in a toxic waste barrel and thrown in the same trench, but never mind. Harvey Wasserman writes, a stunning new report alleges the U.S. Navy knew that sailors from the nuclear-powered USS Ronald Reagan took major radiation hits from the Fukushima atomic power plant after its meltdown and explosions nearly 3 years ago. If true, the revelations cast a new light on the $1 billion lawsuit filed by the sailors against TEPCO. Many of the sailors are already suffering devastating health impacts, but are being stonewalled by TEPCO and the United States Navy. The Reagan had joined several other U.S. ships in Operation Tomodachi, which is apparently Japanese for friendship, to aid victims of the March 11, 2011 quake and tsunami. First, photographic evidence and first-person testimony confirms that on March 12, 2011, the ship was within 2 miles of Fukushima, Fukushima Daiichi, as the reactors there began to melt and explode. In the midst of a snowstorm, deckhands were enveloped in a warm cloud that came with a metallic taste. Sailors testified that the Reagan's 5,500-member crew was told over the ship's intercom to avoid drinking or bathing in desalinized water drawn from a radioactive sea. Golly, there's one of those things I really hoped never to read in the second decade of the 21st century. Desalinized water from a radioactive sea. It sounds like a part of a song lyric, doesn't it? But no, this is the nightmare reality of our modern world that operates without benefit of the precautionary principle. The huge carrier quickly ceased its humanitarian efforts and sailed 100 miles out to sea, where newly published internal Navy communications confirm it was still taking serious doses of radioactive fallout. Scores of sailors from the Reagan and other ships stationed nearby now report a wide range of ailments reminiscent of those documented downwind from atomic bomb tests in the Pacific and Nevada and at Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. Serious fallout was also apparently found on helicopters coming back from relief missions. One unnamed U.S. government expert is quoted in the Japan Focus article as saying, at 100 meters away, the helicopter was reading 4 sieverts per hour. That is an astronomical number, and it told me what the number means to me, a trained person, is there is no water on the reactor cores, and they are just melting down. There is nothing containing the release of radioactivity. It is an unmitigated, unshielded number. And that comes from a confidential communication of September 17, 2012. As a result, transcribed conversations obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, that's where that came from, featured naval officials who acknowledged that even while 100 miles away from Fukushima, the Reagan's readings compared to just normal background are about 30 times what you would expect to detect just on a normal air sample out to sea. On the nuclear-powered carrier, and this is a quote, all of our continuous monitors alarmed at the same level at this value, and then we took portable air samples on the flight deck and got the same value. Meanwhile, and we have friends in San Diego, the Reagan is sitting docked in San Diego. There is no history of successfully deradiating a radiated ship. So, I don't know if it glows in the dark. I presume it doesn't, but it might as well. A heavily radiated United States aircraft carrier is sitting in a dock in San Diego, arguably giving off radiation to everybody near it. All we got in common is our misery. The least we can do is share it. Thanks, Jason. Jason via Twitter. I wish I had another $100 to send you right now for the Reagan comment. F him. Yeah, that greasy-headed old terrorist. God, he makes me crazy. Well, it's morning in America. You realize that just about everything bad that has happened in America since 1981 can be traced to that nasty old warmongering freak, right? Tim from L.A. with a note. I wonder how long before the leaders blamed Fukushima for all the cancer in New Mexico. Hell, officials blamed the death of 14,000 stillbirths in the Pacific Northwest of Fukushima when Hanford is a lot closer and has been leaking for more than 20 years. My theory? Alien tort act, but that's all conspiracy theory. Yeah, and that doesn't mean aliens like from space. It's a real legal thing. I don't know. I'm inclined to think radiation in New Mexico is either a leftover from the atomic testing of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, or else it's this latest and apparently incompetently run site that's storing old, worn out. Well, no, not worn out, really. It takes a long time for plutonium to wear out, doesn't it? Yes, it does. But there's nothing to indicate that the Reagan's reactor was what led to it dosing its crew. It is the fact that it was sailed right into the middle of a nuclear storm. Difficult to fathom. So there's that. Oh, from Ron and Raleigh. Bob. The Navy can't just throw away a perfectly good, if radiated, aircraft carrier. Yeah, but see, Ron, if it's radiated, I think that sort of takes a little bit of the starch out of that perfectly good part, doesn't it? What a jolly little Friday on the front porch we're having. Let's see, what else? Oh, goodness me. Where else? You remember we had the story a few weeks ago before Black History Month started about the Catholic school in California that put out a menu of watermelon, fried chicken, and collard greens in honor of Black History Month. and it had to be pointed out to them, you know, this is really not appropriate. And so they sort of pulled back and reassessed and did some thinking about how one, yeah. It was stupid that they thought of it in the first place, but it was at least admirable that they had the discussion about right versus wrong, racial sensitivity, that kind of thing. Not so in Talibandiana. Apparently that news story did not filter as far as Talibandiana. In particular, Indianapolis, Talibandiana. Once again, it's a private school, not a public school. Hell, the public schools probably can't afford this kind of food. There in Indianapolis, Talibandiana, the apology after the fact, of course, it's always after the fact, except in California they managed to get out in front of it. The problem, the news story from the Indianapolis Star reports, the problem wasn't that Park Tudor School served fried chicken. The tension didn't come from simply doling out collard greens and soul food. The misstep came in calling it a celebration of Black History Month. A celebration of Black History Month. Oddly enough, at this private school, there are some students of color. And when the fried chicken, collards, soul food lunch was served, and was served as a celebration of Black History Month, some of those, probably not very many of them, black students at Park Tudor, said they were hurt and disappointed. And as a consequence, last week, Park Tudor Private School said, "We apologize for what was a clear error in judgment. We recognize the distress and hurt feelings this has caused within our entire community." Now, if you want to go to Park Tudor, the tuition is $15,000 to $19,000 a year. Like I said, not a lot of black students there. Of the 950 students at Park Tudor, 67 are of color. So, oops, fail. John Stanfield is education co-chair at the Greater Indianapolis NAACP. He says, "I'm not surprised," talking about Park Tudor's lunch, Black History Month lunch, "Park Tudor is in serious need of getting very serious in developing effective inclusion and equality. Otherwise, their students are going to have a hard time transitioning in this world." Ew, Texas Betsy noting, "My school serves fried chicken reject parts every Thursday." Parts is parts, Betsy. Parts is parts. The school blamed, there's always some blame, the menu mistake on its food service provider, Aladdin Food Management Systems. Really? Aladdin? Aladdin? Davies said the company crafts meals without needing approval from Park Tudor administrators. And here's the part. Here's the part where I go, oh, no. The West Virginia-based company, yes, Aladdin Food Management Services is a West Virginia-based company, which serves schools and healthcare facilities across the country, declined to comment on the incident or say whether the menu appears in other locations. Oh, my. So insofar as this is an institutional subcontractor, or an institutional contractor, and they make their money by a certain amount of standardization, this just happens to be the school that got caught. How many other Aladdin Food Services customers were served Black History Month meals of fried chicken and collards? We don't know. A real live, honest-to-goodness journalist might actually be interested in finding that out. See, Tim from L.A. got my little wisecrack about the plutonium going away after a short while. Plutonium, Tim notes, has a half-life of 80 million years. After 80 million years, it's half as strong as it was for the first 80 million, and then it drops to a quarter for another 80 million, 1/8, 1/16, 1/32, 1/64. So when it's totally clear, the sun will probably supernova, you know? New Mexico is effed. I'm sorry about using the F word, but I have family 60 miles from the Fukushima plant, and it pisses me off. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the kind of feeling you feel when you know that people you love have had their lives put behind the desires of global corporate operations to make a profit. Profit. I mean, do you think the TEPCO shareholders, do they have shareholders, TEPCO? Bound to. Do you think the TEPCO shareholders look at their little dividend checks and say, huh, I can almost smell the blood coming off of this. Tasty. Wow. So, Yes, in regard to Aladdin Food Management Services, Irish Dave notes, rub my lamp, make a wish. And reminds us that Ronald Reagan made his bones as a spokesmodel for General Electric. Progress is our most important product and shit. Yeah. We've got plenty to talk about on this Friday on the front porch. It looks like, among other things, that, and not that I'm proud of it, but I predicted it, that the attempt to regulate tanks in West Virginia would probably fail. And there are 11 days left in the West Virginia legislative session. And while they have managed to pass some bills, like making sure that bars close earlier and making sure that they inject themselves into women's health care decisions and some making sure that legislators can park their cars and leave all kinds of loaded weapons in them. I mean, they've gotten some work done. But they're not. They're probably not going to get a meaningful tank regulation bill out of the legislature. And, well, so what if they did? They'd be leaving 100-some-odd open toxic waste pits, largely still unregulated, all over the state of West Virginia. And they can go and say, see, we did our jobs. Meanwhile, because people have been watching, some inspectors have gone scurrying around West Virginia, and according to Ken Ward Jr., and I ask again, what do we have to do in order to get this guy a Pulitzer? Inspectors have been scurrying around West Virginia, feverishly trying to look like they meant to do something, trying to find chemical storage tanks that happen to be near public drinking water supplies. Guess what? Yesterday, the Department of Environmental Protection, the West Virginia DEP, the entirely failed agency that couldn't find, that could not make it from McCorkle Avenue over to the Elk River, about a 10-minute drive. They couldn't, it took them 3 hours on January the 9th. Yeah, that West Virginia DEP. The West Virginia DEP that routinely allows massive ammonium nitrate and fuel oil explosions, blasts, to be set off near giant earthen dams holding back billions of gallons of toxic waste, that West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection. The West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection that has never found not one mountaintop removal job that it didn't fairly ache to permit. The same West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection that is loath to acknowledge the growing body of scientific evidence that people who live near mountaintop removal sites are right prone to get poisoned to death. Yeah, that Department of Environmental Protection. Yesterday, they, for the first time, shared with the public a list of storage tanks that might be subject to new storage tank rules, assuming that the legislature passes a storage tank bill. In other words, a list of 1,600 tanks that will not be regulated because the legislature is not going to do diddly, because this, in West Virginia, is a failed state. I don't just, I mean, that's a term of art. I don't just throw failed state around. Government in West Virginia has failed. And it's been failing for generations. You know, two nights ago was the anniversary of the Buffalo Creek disaster in 1972, in which 125 people were killed. Two bodies have never been found to this day. Families were shattered into a million tiny pieces. Thousands of people were left homeless. At least a half a dozen communities were ruined. And that was from a couple of 100 million gallons of toxic waste roaring down the holler. Yeah. And the West Virginia legislature did nothing about that. Shelley Moore Capito's daddy Arch was governor at the time, and the first thing on his mind was to try to keep anybody from knowing how bad it was. He tried to have journalists arrested for trying to report on the disaster. Arch was later imprisoned, having been busted for taking and extorting sackfuls of money from the boys in the coal industry. Well, there are 1,600 tanks that are chemical storage tanks that are located near public drinking water supplies in West Virginia. Ken Ward writes, DEP officials cautioned that they could end up with a final inventory showing even more storage tanks located in or near the zone of critical concern near public water supply intakes. Not one of these will be a massive multi-billion gallon toxic waste dump behind an earthen dam, because they are simply not considered storage tanks. These are just a few tens of thousands of gallons at a time. Then this sentence. DEP inspectors are still visiting more than 100 sites they believe have tanks located near drinking water intakes. There's that troublesome word that they believe. They don't know, because they've never bothered to inventory these things before, ever. The DEP looked at water pollution permit information, compared that to mapping data that pinpoint water intake locations, and then went through permit files to identify facilities with plans showing storage tanks. Those are just plans. Those are not permits. There's every reason in the world to believe none of them have ever been inspected any more than the tanks were inspected at Freedom Industries. The latest numbers from DEP show 595 facilities with an estimated 3,953 above-ground storage tanks. Of those facilities with 1,618 storage tanks are located within close proximity to a public water supply. The new lists from DEP include sites like coal-fired power plants, chemical plants, lumber mills, trucking operations. Still, the list that was released doesn't include a list of what the chemicals are. Now, notice that list. Wide variety of sites, from coal-fired power stations and chemical plants to lumber mills and trucking operations. Ken Ward is a very good reporter, and I can't help thinking that, as thorough as he is, if the list had included coal preparation plants, he would have said so. I mean, for instance, coal preparation plants have anhydrous ammonia tanks. That crap gets loose, a whole bunch of people die. Doesn't even have to go in a water supply, does it? I didn't think so. And then I love the bass-ackward reasoning of the spokesman for the DEP, Tom Aloise.
As we make our way to more and more of the sites in the zones of critical concern, we'll potentially discover fewer or more tanks than we originally estimated. Our focus right now is to get accurate information on the sites in the zones of critical concern.
Inescapable logic. You just can't argue with it. So the DEP, kind of grudgingly, is going out and finding these things, and the legislature is busting its ass to make sure that it doesn't in any way offend the people who own them by suggesting that maybe they need to be kept an eye on so that another Freedom Industries disaster won't take place. And by the way, all these DEP workers who are fanning out there to do this work, one suspects that they are being repurposed from other tasks within West Virginia DEP, because one would have to note that, for instance, in the mining division, way back when Joe Manchin was still just governor of West Virginia, the DEP had job openings, which Joe, under the guise of saying he was going to protect the budget, refused to fill. And so when somebody would reach retirement age and retire, they wouldn't hire a new guy or new woman, because the coal industry was deemed to be overregulated as it was. And so that's another layer of fail into this entire, you know, Dagwood sandwich of fail. Even if the DEP can find them all, and even if the legislature pretended to actually be interested in protecting the well-being of West Virginians and passed a bill mandating regular and routine inspection, guess what? There would not be enough DEP inspectors to do the inspecting. That's why the present bill, which isn't even going to pass more than likely, allows the industry to inspect itself and pick up the phone and say, Sarah, get me the DEP. Hello, Inspector Fife. We just inspected our tank. Yeah, it's more rust than it is metal, but we've inspected it and found it to be just fine. Is that all right by you? It is. You have a lovely day. We'll call you back in 10 years. I wish I was joking. I'm not. Irish Dave, now in post-production, Field of Tanks. If you build it, it will leak. Coming to a neighborhood near you. In a world of leaking tanks. Oh, Jesus. And I want to remind the fine folks and members of the Horn family who are up anywhere near western Pennsylvania that hidden somewhere up there and certainly not available for public scrutiny or protest or complaint or comment is the entire inventory of Freedom Industries methyl chlorohexane methanol, which is, as compared to some of the other chemicals used in the coal industry, kind of a piker. But nonetheless, it has been slipped up there in the dark and still of the night, and nobody's publicizing where it is, are they? But it's probably sitting somewhere near the Monongahela River, or maybe it's sitting somewhere near the Allegheny River. And one of these days, you might get to wake up and say, you know, some guy down on Forbes Avenue, hey, that's just Dantan, and I smelled some licorice. What's that licorice smell? Oh, that's profit, my fine Pittsburgh friend. That's profit you're smelling. You betcha. And thanks, by the way, to Sylvia and to Sal. Between Sylvia, Sal, and Ed, we are now $60 toward our $150 fundraising goal for the evening. That's a big help. Sylvia notes, love all your aptly named daily segments. You make my afternoons. Hope you'll have better news to share with us as well. I'm trying. They're just not putting out a heck of a lot of it. I mean, by the way, a little update. Remember how the news story last night about the man who was shot for reaching for his walking cane? You know, hand me down my... 70-year-old guy in York County, South Carolina, who was shot by the 24-year-old deputy for the apparently summary offense of reaching for walking stick. And I said we didn't know where he'd been shot. Well, there was a reason that news story closed with the man is expected to survive as opposed to live. They shot him in the chest. Not they, he. The officer, the deputy in question, the 24-year-old deputy. And the spokesman said, it appears to be a completely acceptable use of deadly force to shoot a 70-year-old reaching for his walking stick. Well, then there's Saginaw, Michigan. The FBI and U.S. Department of Justice have announced that they will not charge the officers involved in shooting a 49-year-old mentally ill man six police officers fired 47 times at Milton Hall. Out of the 47 rounds they expended from their surface weapons, they hit him 11 times.
this happened back in July 2012, when a convenience store called the cops to say that a beverage had been stolen. The way it played out, Police Sergeant Anjanette Wachowski, Wojciechowski, arrived on the scene first and called for backup because she said the suspect didn't look so nice. Yes, it was clear he was not wearing a bespoke suit. You may fire at will, Gridley. Milton Hall dialed 911 trying to get help. After police had surrounded him and sicked dogs on him. So no officer will be penalized in the least for blowing away with 11 rounds out of 47 shots fired a mentally ill man. Let's take a little trip to Houston, Texas. You know, we talked at the beginning of the program last night a little bit about the Republicans deciding to tell America's veterans to stuff it. I guess it'll come no surprise then to note that a veteran of 23 years in the United States Army and Navy who is diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder has reported that while he was at a Thai Spice Buffet 2 in the Houston area, he walked in with his service dog. Service dog's named Bandit. And the Thai Spice Buffet 2 denied him service. So he called the police, and an officer arrived, took one look at Area Ohayon. Ohayon said, I told him what my disabilities were, and that's when the officer said, you're not blind. I don't say why you need the dog. The officer then claims he called the Harris County District Attorney's Office, who told him that Thai Spice Buffet 2 was allowed to bar the door to Ohayon because it is a private establishment. And we were all worried about what Arizona was thinking about doing. Oh, mercy. And then, oh, God, then there's Idaho. I've mentioned before, I think, that I come from a long line of teachers. My grandmother, most of her sisters, who would be great aunts of mine, one of my father's sisters, my sister, teachers, all, and fine ones, fine teachers. And in my knowing of them, they were all very much concerned with fulfilling the mission of teaching children to read and write and do their numbers and
hopefully be meaningful, productive members of society, as the saying goes. There were some funny stories along the way. I've related a couple of them in the past. And they all had their various techniques and methods for teaching. And being as how they, most of them were teaching in West Virginia, especially that older generation, they were largely concerned with whether or not children could get to school, whether or not children had enough to eat, whether or not children had the ability to get their lessons done, whether or not they were getting their lessons right, spelling and grammar and sentence diagramming, that kind of thing. Well, apparently some of that stuff has sort of gone by the boards in Idaho. TPM reporting, and oh my God, Dr. Bill O'Brien is a college professor. Our dear friend Dr. John is a college professor. And I just can't imagine this coming out of, our good friend Professor Keith Lilly, college professor. And I can't imagine any of them asking this question. Boise State University. Has been concerned about a bill in the Idaho legislature that would permit concealed carry firearms on Idaho's college and university campuses. Yeah, that's going to work out well. Kind of like the story I saw the other day that Israel is experimenting with putting anti-missiles on civilian jetliners. What a great idea. Lusitania? Anybody? Bueller? Well, this is another one of those good ideas. Let's have everybody armed and dangerous trying to pass English 101. Enter biology and criminal justice professor. What an interesting combination. Your dead frog has the right to remain silent. Anything it croaks can and will be used against it in a pan that's full of wax. It may have its skin pinned back onto the wax while you inspect its innards. Never mind. Biology and criminal justice professor Greg Hampikian. Really? H-A-M-P-I-K-I-A-N. Greg Hampikian. Got himself an op-ed published in the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And he is concerned about this bill being put forward by the Idaho State Legislature, which has apparently gone completely nuts. Yesterday, in the New York Times opinion pages, he wrote, "To the chief counsel of the Idaho State Legislature, in light of the bill permitting guns on our state's college and university campuses, which is likely to be approved by the State House of Representatives in the coming days, I have a matter of practical concern that I hope you can help with. When may I shoot a student? I'm a biology professor, not a lawyer, and I had never considered bringing a gun to work until now. But since many of my students are likely to be armed, I thought it would be a good idea to even the playing field. I've had encounters with disgruntled students over the years, some of whom seemed quite upset, but I always assumed that when they reached into their backpacks, they were going for a pencil. Since I carry a pen to lecture, I did not feel outgunned, and because there are no working sharpeners in the lecture hall, the most they could get off is a single point. But now that we'll all be packing heat, I would like legal instruction in the rules of classroom engagement. At present, the harshest penalty available here at Boise State is expulsion, used only for the most heinous crimes like cheating on Scantron exams. But now that lethal force is an option, I need to know which infractions may be treated as de facto capital crimes." you know, de facto capital crimes like reaching for your walking stick in South Carolina. This guy's got a point. I assume that if a student shoots first, I am allowed to empty my clip. But given the velocity of firearms and my aging reflexes, I'd like to be proactive. For example, if I'm working out a long equation on the board and several students try to correct me using their laser sights, am I allowed to fire a warning shot? If two armed students are arguing over who should be served next at the coffee bar and I sense escalating hostility, should I aim for the legs and remind them of the campus shared values statement, which reads in part, Boise State strives to provide a culture of civility and success where all feel safe and free from discrimination, harassment, threats, or intimidation? While our city police chief has expressed grave concerns about allowing guns on campus, I would point out that he already has one. I'm glad that you were not intimidated by him and did not allow him to speak at the public hearing on the bill, although I really enjoyed the 40 minutes you gave to the National Rifle Association spokesman. Well, this guy's good. Knee-jerk reactions from law enforcement officials and university presidents are best set aside. Ignore, for example, the lame argument that some drunken frat boys will fire their weapons in violation of best practices. This view is based on stereotypical depictions of drunken frat boys, a group whose dignity no one seems willing to defend. Really? This guy's a biology and criminal justice professor? May I suggest he be given a tenured chair in the creative writing department of the Division of English? The problem, of course, is not that drunken frat boys will be armed. It is that they are drunken frat boys. Arming them is clearly not the issue. They would cause damage with or without guns. I would point out that urinating against a building or firing a few rounds into a sorority house are both violations of the same honor code. In terms of the campus murder rate, zero at present. I think that we can all agree that guns don't kill people. People with guns do, which is why encouraging guns on campus makes so much sense. Bad guys go where there are no guns. So by adding guns to campus, more bad guys will spend their year abroad in London. Britain has incredibly restrictive laws. Their cops don't even have guns. And gun deaths there are a tiny fraction of what they are in America. It's a perfect place for bad guys. Really, I think somebody needs to endow the Jonathan Swift Chair of Literature and Satire in the English Department of Boise State University and give it to Professor Hampikian on the double quick, please. Once again, this reflects, since some of my colleagues are concerned that you are encouraging firearms within a densely packed concentration of young people who are away from home for the first time and are coincidentally the age associated with alcohol and drug experimentation and the commission of felonies. Once again, this reflects outdated thinking about students. My current students have grown up learning responsible weapon use through virtual training available on the Xbox and PlayStation. Far from being enamored of violence, many studies have shown they are numb to it. These creative young minds will certainly be stimulated by access to more technology at the university, items like autoloaders, silencers, and hollow points. I'm sure that it has not escaped your attention that the library would make an excellent shooting range, and the bookstore could do with fewer books and more ammo choices. I want to applaud the legislature's courage. On a final note, I hope its members will consider my amendment for bulletproof office windows and faculty body armor in Boise State blue and orange. I do love good satire. That's just brilliant. Greg Hampikian. With a modest, I mean, really, this might as well be called a modest proposal for Idaho's universities. He's a good one. Oh, okay, sorry. Irish Dave pointing. Wrong, Bob, wrong. The Idaho legislature is always been nuts. Real nuts. That's true. Has gone is probably the wrong verb tense. Maybe even the wrong mood. Well, you see where this Friday on the front porch is headed. Not really. It could really go anywhere, couldn't it? And that's kind of the purpose of Friday on the front porch. You are above all invited to join in. We will take a little break. And hopefully we will fire up Friday on the front porch. Sorry, I'm looking for a song here. We'll get started on Friday on the front porch. We made an excellent start toward fundraising for this evening with $60 out of $150 taken care of. Thank you all very much. And you know the number, 304-658-3333. We have, there's one. It looks like we've got two lines left open there. And, of course, the Horn Molloy Skype chat group moderated by the indefatigable Sparky. This is Conversation Radio on Friday on the Front Porch. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. In Chains and Damn the River seemed appropriate to the moment. I love the way you guys' minds work. Kate pointing out, with regard to the last story about the professor from Boise State, Just perfect. A nice shot at the LDS on their trip to London where there are no guns. A lot of the young missionaries, blah, blah. He has my kind of humor. And then Irish Dave, the question arises, will the vandals of the University of Idaho be encouraged to arm up? Though they are in Moscow, so we'll probably be watching Ukraine. Yeah. It is Friday on the Front Porch, and we are ready to begin the Friday on the Front Porch Forum. Let us begin with the Horn Malloy Skype chat group. Good evening. Good evening, Sparky.
Good evening, Bob.
And in the rest of the Mouseketeer roll call, we have Sergi. And we have Tim. Jeremy's joined us.
Hey, everyone.
Hello, Jeremy.
Betsy's with us. So is Greg. Larry is with us.
Hey, Bob.
Yep, hi.
And,
hey, Bob.
Good evening. Grant and Jeffrey is with us from the Netherlands. Good evening, all.
Hey, Bob.
Good evening.
Konnichiwa, Bob-san.
Konnichiwa, Tim-san. Nandeska, Konadeska. Best I can do. And let's check out who's on the various and sundry phone lines. Welcome to Friday on the Front Porch.
That me, Big Gay?
I think that is you, Dan.
Good evening, Bob.
Good evening. And we'll just go right down the line. Welcome to Friday on the Front Porch.
What's up, Bob?
Hey, what's up? Is that Jim?
Yeah, Jim and we can understand.
Awesome. And welcome to Friday on the Front Porch.
You talking to me?
I'm talking to Bill. Okay, so we got Dan, and we got Jim, and we got Bill, and we got one more. Hey, welcome to Friday on the Front Porch.
Hello?
Hello, Edward?
Yes. I listened to your program last night with Tracy and thoroughly enjoyed it. And this is not going to be a food porn thing, but in one of my English cookbooks, I found this recipe. I knew where it was. It's she might like this. It's Phragmum mammalia. I did not pronounce that correctly, but it translates strawberry breasts. And the description is a pink plate with two erect feminine breasts made of ricotta dyed pink with Campari, with nipples of candied strawberries. More fresh strawberries under the cover of ricotta, making it possible to bite into an ideal multiplication of imaginary breasts.
This is from an old English cookbook?
This is not an old one, but it's an English cookbook. Just wanted to let... Let Tracy know.
Those English, so sedate, you turn your back on them for a minute, and they're making strawberry breasts.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. But anyway, you all have a good evening and have a good weekend.
And you as well, Edward. And we will talk soon.
Very good. Right. And try one of those strawberry breasts if you can find one.
I might have to make one. Who knows?
Take care.
Bye now.
Bye.
Edward calling from Dallas, and let's bring one more on the line. Hey, welcome to Friday on the Front Porch.
Hello.
Good evening, Jim.
How are you?
I'm well. I'm well, thank you. We now have our full Friday on the Front Porch contingent, compliment, what have you. 18 minutes past the hour, and who wants to start and go where?
Just this to Edward. I'm having a shot of Campari right now.
Well, that sounds lovely. I guess it would do a nice job in turning ricotta pink, wouldn't it?
Real food, oh, yeah, but I'd never waste Campari on something like that. Oh, hell no.
Well, the one thing I'd like to start with is that story I think you led off with yesterday about the, or was in the show, about the veterans of the Iraq, Afghanistan invasion and occupation, and you know, it's a shame to do it, but it's like, what do you expect? I mean, this just seems like SOP for this government, this corporate government that we have.
Yeah, but
It is, Jim. But by the same token, I don't know about the rest of the group. But once in a while, it's kind of shocking to find out just exactly how low your average GOP member of the Senate and or House have sunken.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm just everybody's that long. Sound of the gunfire. I'm used to it now. Talking heads line. But it's like when in what 06, out of the blue, Bush just all of a sudden cut education benefits or something. Correct me if I'm wrong, but sometime during the war, cut back on education benefits for troops serving.
I remember something like that, but I can't quite get a brain cell on it. I'm sure somebody will shoot an email to me.
In Paul Begala's book, it's still the economy, stupid. He referenced No Child Left Behind, and Bush got Ted Kennedy to support that bill and shepherd it through the Senate, and then knifed Kennedy in the back by underfunding it right out of the chute. And I don't know if that was pre or post. War, and I suppose it was post of Afghanistan, but pre-Iraq. But he lowballed education his entire presidency, as with any other programs that helped folks other than the wealthy and the corporations.
Well, you must remember, the thing we have to ask is our children learning?
Right. That's uniquely American. I love it when you do that one, Bob.
Oh, it's irresistible. We have learned that man and fish can live together in peace.
as long as I have the hook.
And you know, when he was speaking to that woman, he clearly didn't get it. I screamed, "You fucking moron! You're not even getting what she's telling you."
That the one working three jobs.
Yeah.
Yes.
That was Minnesota, wasn't it?
I don't remember.
Yeah, I think it is.
My brain exploded at that point. But as bad as Obama has been in continuing a lot of the criminal Bush policies, drones, et cetera, torture, et cetera, indefinite detention, Bush was just a disaster. And he was a continuation of Reagan. For the longest time, I wanted to resist giving Reagan much credit for starting this mess. But when you look back in history, the last 30, 35 years, and how it's cascaded against ordinary people, it really damn sure is so much Reagan's fault.
He didn't start it. He just picked up the ball and ran.
Well, I understand that, yeah. and we can also go back to the Nixon administration and those bastards and what they did. One junior fellow in the Nixon White House who told Nixon, and he was there at the fall of that administration because of Watergate, and he was determined as a representative that he wanted to rebuild the power of the executive branch. That's Dick Cheney. And there's another guy that was key. He's a thorn in everyone's side right now. He was a young operative in the Nixon White House. And when Nixon was being tortured by Jack Anderson and other investigative journalists, this guy sat on a couch in Nixon's office and told him, "Mr. President, we need GOP TV." And that guy's name is Roger Ailes.
Yep.
President of Fox News.
Former occasional boss of Bill.
Yeah, I did some work for him here when he was investigating the hippies.
Yeah.
Of course, nobody knew who they had. All I knew about the guy, he was promoting Mike Douglas's TV show. That's all I knew about the guy. And I knew he was... I'm at portly side.
Well, I mean, who knew then how dangerous these bastards would grow to be?
Yeah.
Well,
know what they were, you know.
You and Bob and I talked about a while back about, like, like in Rome, it just became a family thing of people getting in Bush 1, and then 8 years later, another Bush, and then that's what's got me kind of worried about Hillary Clinton. Clinton 1, and then Hillary, you know, I mean, I don't think she'd be as bad, but it seems like we're back in ancient Rome where families just run the country.
Yeah.
I think that's just a natural evolutionary outgrowth of oligarchy and plutocracy? Hey, one more thing to consider, because you know we've got a lot of folks out on the West Coast that are members of the Horn Family Commune. Over at KCET.org, under a subheading called Rewire, I ran across something by Chris Clark, and it's the kind of headline that sort of makes you, well, you know, scream and run naked around the yard. Fracking waste is being dumped into the ocean off California's coast. Rewire has reported previously on a form of oil well enhancement in California that doesn't get much attention from the press, namely offshore fracking. At least 12 rigs off the coast of California inject proprietary mixes of potentially dangerous chemicals into undersea rock formations at high pressure. They do this in order to break those rocks up, which makes it easier to pump out the crude. That's fracking. Okay, somebody's kind of crackly there. Do we know who?
Not me.
Well, it seems to have stopped.
Hey, it looks like it was coming from you, as far as I could tell on Skype.
Yeah, I think it was coming from the phones.
The fella from California. What's his name, the gent that's on the phone now?
Sparky.
No, not Sparky. The other guy from L.A.
Tim?
No, there's a guy that I used to hear on a radio show out of the West Coast. I'm pretty sure.
Oh.
Out of L.A.?
Brad Friedman?
I can't remember now.
Norman Goldman?
No, this guy was on tonight. You called out his name on the West Coast. From L.A., I believe.
No.
Oh, Jesus, I am. Better watch it, Bill. I thought I heard a name of the guy I used to hear who was part of a group of four people on a strong left-wing West Coast radio show that used to show up every week and enlighten me. And I'm not being sarcastic for a change.
Oh, I understand. But just to jump back to this issue, the Center for Biological Diversity has noted that this fracking fluid that gets dumped into the Pacific Ocean off California's coast as wastewater. Center for Biological Diversity has pointed out that oil rig operators have federal permits to dump more than 9 billion gallons of fracking wastewater into California's ocean waters every year.
Jeez.
Now, it's always beneficial when you see a number like 9 billion gallons of something. What does that mean? When I first read this story, I saw 9 billion gallons, and I thought, that's the Brushy Fork impoundment in western Raleigh County, you know, because we've talked a lot about the Brushy Fork impoundment. Well, guess what 9 billion gallons is? And just so we can better understand what's sitting in an unlined toxic waste sea behind an earth and rock dam in western Raleigh County, 9 billion gallons of something is enough to fill more than 100 stadiums the size of the Rose Bowl brim full of toxic waste.
Wow.
And, I mean, California is known for actually giving a damn about its environment and the people who live in it. Are there any angry mobs of tens of thousands of people demanding some sort of redress of this grievance? Tim, you kind of keep your finger on that pulse out there. Is anybody paying attention to this?
I don't know if he's going to talk or not, Bob.
Oh, well, okay.
Wouldn't they be labeled as terrorists?
You mean the people objecting to being poisoned? Yeah, that's how it works a lot of the time these days.
Yeah, but they don't make a lot of noise when they're croaking.
The only seawells I know of that are still are down around Santa Barbara.
This thing notes 12 rigs off the coast of California.
Yes, it'd have to be down around Santa Barbara area.
Yeah, it'd have to be Santa Barbara.
Well, do you think that's basically fracking underwater, which in, Oklahoma's been causing those many earthquakes. And California's already prone to earthquakes, the last I heard, right?
Yes.
That might kind of increase earthquakes.
Greg and Tim feel them more than I do.
No, it's not.
Fortunately, not lately.
Well, one of the things this article points out is that, and maybe it is down around Santa Barbara, the rigs are visible from shore.
Yeah, that's Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. They're the only ones that have rigs offshore.
So if the rigs are visible from shore, doesn't that mean at some point the nature of the coastal current is going to carry that fracking waste onto land?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, not necessarily at Santa Barbara, but, hell, maybe Alaska? Currents being current and everything?
Maybe south of Santa Barbara. All the sand migrates south.
Oh, okay.
The oil probably would also.
Since the 40s, I believe it is, there's been a ship that sunk in Lake Erie that was oozing oil for years and years. Was it Cleve Coal or something like that?
Yeah, I read something about that somewhere.
Yeah, that was it. Well, I haven't heard anything about it lately because, the newspapers are too busy covering the gun permit holders and all that stuff,
Well, here's a fun little paragraph. Fracking wastewater contains more than just the chemicals used by oil and gas companies to break up the rocks, including methanol, benzene, naphthalene,
I love that,
and trimethyl benzene.
I love that too.
And in the process of the fracking, some stuff comes up with it, and that includes lead and arsenic.
You always know when the name of a chemical looks like a scrapple board explosion, you know it's bad news.
Yeah, you know you don't want it on the Wheaties.
That's what I was about to suggest.
Well, they used to make us clean wood floors when I was in the third and fourth grade. We used wood floors on clean the wood floors in the classrooms. We used steel wool and benzene. And the old Volkswagen...
You ain't dead yet, are you?
Manuals used to tell you to use benzene to flush the... between, when you do an oil change. Of course, they stopped doing that. They stopped telling you that.
Because
we
Americans
wonder
got...
what people have already had to deal with years ago and had no concept of what they were doing.
Wow. Just wow.
Like...
Sorry, I didn't make
what do you think would happen if Bernie Sanders led the Democrats to introduce a bill like that was to support the troops? The troops are assets, the vets are liabilities. But
true.
The one that went down to defeat recently. And how the hell does a 56-41 vote spell defeat? What do they need? 61 votes or
60.
Something?
60. They got to have 60. And by the way, out of that, let's just revisit that real quick, Dan. There were two Republicans who voted in favor of the measure. The guy named Moran from Kansas, and a senator from Nevada. Can we finally, once and for all, put paid, put to bed, put in the cellar, put away this notion that the Republican senator from Maine,
yes,
is somehow a freaking moderate.
You're talking about Susan Collins?
Yeah. You don't get to be a moderate and vote against veterans' benefits.
And her little running mate, the little Greek, isn't there another woman from New England? I forgot her last name, but...
There used to be two, I thought.
Yeah.
Well, no, Olympia Snow is gone. She was replaced by Angus King, who voted for the bill.
Okay.
Irish Dave noting 56 minus 41 plus Diebold equals, well, you know.
Was that two-thirds thing in the Constitution, or was that?
No. Four-fifths is in the Constitution. No, never. Sorry.
Senate rule.
I wouldn't mind a-fifth, but I don't know about four.
Well, you know, I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy.
Lobotomy, right.
But no, it's not in the Constitution. Those are just Senate rules.
I thought so.
So, Susan Collins voting against this thing. But the point that I was making is these people ought to be shamed on a weekly basis.
Sure.
This is not something that should go away because the feckless Democrats are feeling all defeated.
Bernie says he's going to try to bring it back somehow, but, you know, there are rules about that. You can't just sit there and bring a bill back and bring a bill back and bring a bill back.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, but I think that points to the larger issue, and that is there was a certain amount of yay, hooray, this is a great day for America when we had that little itsy-bitsy, teeny-teeny, tiny, almost microscopic, almost incomprehensibly small reform to the filibuster process whereby we actually get to put judges on the bench now and associate assistant deputy administrators of the Department of the Department of Toilet Paper Selection.
Yeah, the dog catchers.
But the fact of the matter is, the Senate still remains mired deeply in dysfunction, and there's another example of that. I think it was a couple or three weeks ago, I made mention of the nomination of Dr. Vivek Murthy, who is the nominee for Surgeon General of the United States. You might recall that Pat Roberts of Kansas invited Dr. Murthy to come and visit Kansas sometime because there's a lovely little Hindu doctor in his town.
He was playing matchmaker.
Right. I mean, I don't know what Sanskrit is for Yentl, but, you know, he was.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
But okay, so that presaged what was later to come. Guess what? His nomination has been put on hold simply because he has stated publicly that gun violence in the United States of America is a major public health threat. The NRA has demanded of its compliant members of the Senate that Dr. Vivek Murthy's nomination be ruined. Here's the letter from the NRA. Dr. Murthy's record of political activism in support of radical gun control measures raises significant concerns about his ability to objectively examine issues pertinent to America's 100 million firearm owners and the likelihood that he would use the office of the Surgeon General to further his pre-existing campaign against gun ownership. Yeah, that was, by the way, wrong accent. That was written by Chris Cox. Given Dr. Murthy's lengthy history of hostility towards the right to keep and bear arms, along with his calls for the full weight of the federal government's health apparatus to be used to target lawful gun ownership, there's little reason to believe that he would not work to further a gun control agenda if confirmed as Surgeon General. Simply put, the confirmation of Dr. Murthy is a prescription for disaster for America's gun owners. Not a word in there about how gun violence in America is a prescription for daggum death for Americans' gun violence victims.
Yeah, well, it's like that, what, when the 4-year-old killed his 2-year-old sister. What was that? I heard that on your show, Mike Malloy's show, a couple months ago.
Oh, which one? You got 9-year-olds shooting 2-year-olds, 10-year-olds shooting 9-year-olds, 4-year-olds shooting 1-year-olds. I mean, Jesus.
Tell you, in 79, I was dancing spending time with a woman. Well, it was one of those situations where it was the daughter of an ex-mistress of mine that she sent me on her daughter and vice versa, and her daughter had a 2-year-old, and I'll tell you what, when I walked in that house, that gun was empty when I walked in the house, and the bullets were in my pocket, and the gun was on a shelf. I mean, it's just goddamn common sense tells anybody with a brain you don't leave loaded weapons around children. I mean, it's bad enough carrying it. I felt ashamed of myself for carrying the goddamn thing.
Well, it turns out, Bill, that Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, has followed through on the NRA orders, and he has placed a hold on Dr. Murthy's nomination. And he wrote a letter, too.
No, he had somebody write it for him, if I know him.
No, he just took it from somebody else's writing.
Okay, thank you. Sick.
In his efforts to curtail Second Amendment rights, Dr. Murthy has continually referred to guns as a public health issue on par with heart disease and has diminished the role of mental health in gun violence. Now, this is a letter libertarian ophthalmologist Rand Paul wrote to Harry Reid. Well, can we just ask a question here real quick? In the United States, in any given year, how many children die of heart disease versus how many children die of gun violence? Because if the numbers are anywhere near on par with one another, then guess what? Gun violence is a problem in America, a health problem in America, like heart disease. I mean, this is sickening.
I'll tell you what, as a child, I had every style of weapon there was, a double-barrel shotgun. All these toy guns were just this, and if you were Roy Rogers, you wore two of them, just in case. It was just unbelievable.
Oh, I grew up with toy guns, toy rifles, toy machine guns.
Yep. Well, I had a damn submachine gun with a barrel on it, like the gangster-style thing.
My G.I. Joes had bazookas.
Yeah,
I grew up with toy guns and stuff, you know. But I mean, it breeds
a mentality.
Decades.
But I love this part from Rand Paul's letter. As a physician, and you have to put a paren there, even though he didn't.
Physician my ass.
As a physician who could not pass board certification exams and therefore invented my own certifying organization, I am deeply concerned that he has advocated that doctors use their position of trust to ask patients, including minors, details about gun ownership in the home. Well, obviously, Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, is not capable of engaging in rational thought, so let's do it for him. And this is just a fact. If a child lives in a home with firearms, the statistical likelihood of that child either being the receiver or a witness to gun violence has to be orders of magnitude higher than the likelihood of a child witnessing or receiving the same who lives in a home without them. I mean, doesn't that make a little bit of sense?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you're a child in a home in, say, Somalia or Haiti or Afghanistan or, wait, the United States.
Chicago is going to say.
Chicago, true enough.
Well, I knew I arrived when I went out and bought a Mossberg with five shots in it to... You could empty the front door or whatever. It gets to be a mindset that can chase you up a wall after a while.
See, like, the other thing that fascinates me about people and their guns is, like, that guy who blew his brains out in front of his girlfriend with the three guns. Why do you need three guns? You only have two hands. It's just, you know... Yeah, he's showing her how.
Well, I could never do that.
One for the toes, man. One for the toes.
And then that,
all three of them weren't unloaded, and bam, the third shot was the dead shot.
Man.
That proves about evolution, you know? I mean, you're stupid enough to put a gun by your head, even if you think it's empty. That's evolution. You don't deserve to.
So there were in that story out of Oakland County, Michigan that we're talking about. Remember, he was the live-in boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And Mama had three children by a previous relationship. All right. So she allowed boyfriend to move in and move his guns in with him. We sort of just need to keep that in perspective or keep that in the backs of our minds somewhere.
She's got three kids and she allows them to move in. What was
each with three guns?
A gun for each kid, and then he's going to get one for her and one for him, additional.
For all we know, they were already there. These just happened to be the three that he was using to show his statistical proficiency.
It reminds me of that old Saturday Night Live fake commercial. I mean, from when it started, you know, they drive by, show me your guns, remember? And it's just like a car going by, and all these people just pull out their guns, and they're showing their guns. Yeah, that's 30 years, 40, well, not 40, 30 some odd years ago, 35.
God.
Well, I guess it's like the Beatles said, you know, happiness is a warm gun.
Bang, bang, shoot, yeah. Shoot.
Well, watch out for your pinky toe now.
Hey, Jim, you said that you've got folks down in South Carolina who are under a boil water advisory?
Oh, yeah. Sure do.
Why?
They don't know yet. It hasn't been made public yet. But I can remember.
Whereabouts in South Carolina?
Oh, no. Correction. When I lived in D.C., we had those three times a week.
Boil water alert?
Yeah, and they were looking for a particular organism called cryptosporidiosis, which is something that affects adversely sheep, and when sheep get it, they have to shoot them. But this was because of the people in the district who were having problems with their immune system.
In South Carolina?
No, it was when I lived in.
Oh, okay. But you said that they're under a boil water advisory in South Carolina.
Yeah, they are, and they don't know why. Hasn't been made public, and they don't know. And I think the notice to do so is be given a time frame of 3 weeks. Three days. 3 days. That's what it is. So who knows, something may have gone wrong with the water company. It seems to be kind of endemic or spreading around, doesn't it?
Well, often you will have boil water advisories after hard freezes when water main breaks. Actually, we were under a boil water advisory here in this county at the same time that the Freedom Industries disaster was taking place.
Well, that's what I told my relative. I said, I think it may have to do with the hard freeze and the damage that it may have done to water pipes and things like that. But nonetheless, you know, there it is. There you have it. I mean, it would appear to me as though, maybe not in South Carolina, but water pipes should be able to withstand a little bit of cold weather. But that's just me.
Well, the thing is, down South Carolina way and in a lot of southern states, they don't bury the water mains to the same depth that they do in northern states.
No, they don't. No. Absolutely
we have
not.
To because of the frost line, yeah.
But the earth moves with a hard freeze and then thaw, and even if the water mains are well below the frost line, you've got tight earth.
Yeah.
Remember, it's very hard packed. So if you've got movement above the frost line, it's going to affect the earth below that line, and that's why water mains break. I was on call a few years ago as a locator. It was around this time of year, and I got 31 calls out after hours that week. 31, that's four a day. Four a day, I think. And and they were all water related, water and gas line related. So it's not quite so cut and dried, but
we have had our
share of cryptosporidium scares up here too. And our water, the Syracuse City water comes from Skaneateles Lake, which is alleged to be one of the cleanest, and it's one of the deepest lakes around. It's one of the Finger Lakes. And however this microbe gets into the water, I don't know. We were never under a boil water state of emergency type thing, but there were alerts, there were reports, and Syracuse Water Department sent out their obligatory flyers. And I never got sick. Nobody I knew ever got sick. But I would imagine the young and the elderly were, those with the compromised immune systems would be most at risk. But it's not unusual. Bob, you mentioned you referenced something the other night. I think you were talking to Bill, and I missed it the first time around, and when I heard the rebroadcast, I missed it the second time around. The phrase that you used was savage law, and it was something that you were quoting from either an article or a book.
That was from a John D. MacDonald novel of 1968 called The Girl in the Plain Brown Wrapper. And I mean, and it really stuck with me.
Excuse me, Bob. You know, there's so much in those classic American crime novels that are just full of truth and corruption of this, the whole system.
Thank you, Bob.
The writer, yeah, and you know, there's a continuum that starts kind of with Dashiell Hammett. It goes up through Raymond Chandler.
Yep.
And John D. MacDonald's part of it. And, for instance, one of the reasons I like John D. MacDonald is you can see in the years even predating Rachel Carson,
yeah,
in his writing, you can see the beginnings of an environmental consciousness, and it's coming through John D. MacDonald writing about the overdevelopment and the poisoning of Florida.
Rachel Carson, Silent Spring.
God, Silent Spring. That book came out in the 50s.
Yeah, and yeah. MacDonald was writing about the about environmental issues before she published.
Mm-hmm. I remember that quite well.
Think about as far back as that was written. He was talking about savage law.
Yeah.
That's how far down that stinking rabbit hole we've come to be at this point.
Oh, without a doubt. And it's gotten worse, because one of the things he says in that particular passage is that a judge with any conscience and any kind of moral sense will do and he used the masculine pronoun at the time, he will do whatever he can to make sure that he doesn't impose the harshest penalty on on simple possession. Because he knows what the felony rap means. But the thing is, it would be, 18 years after John D. MacDonald wrote that, the Congress of the United States, in a frenzy of desperation to be able to go back home and tell the folks back home in the constituency that they were being tough on crime... Probably have to say that with the echo, but I'll let that go. Passed the Sentencing Guidelines Act, which, among other things, took away from judges...
Yeah, their discretion.
Their sentencing discretion, and instead created this mandatory schedule of brutality.
Was that early 70s, Bob?
The Sentencing Guidelines?
Yes, sir.
No, no, no. Those come around in like 1986.
Okay. Oh, Reagan.
Of course.
Yep. And now we have the prison industrial complex. More prisoners, more people in prison than any other country in the world. It's something to be proud of. Makes you proud to be an American, isn't it?
And just what makes me want to queue up God Bless the USA.
You really want to hear something, you ought to hear.
No, please don't.
I'll do my best, Greg.
A commercial for Harry Truman.
Oh, really?
Yep. What's his name? Tom Hartman played it a few times. Talk about a cheap laugh. There you go.
Well, tell us more, Bill.
What?
No, he said, tell us more, Bill.
Well, that's just what, you know, I've heard him play it quite a few times where, because Reagan was, wasn't he with the Screen Actors Guild for a while,
yes,
too?
He was president of the SAG, yes, he was.
Well, yeah. Jim, you and my uncle would have got along well. He had a job delivering movies to neighborhood theaters back in the day when they did that, and this guy, my uncle, knew who ran these studios and such, and you really got a look at the, well, you know, what's his name? Bogart had a big battle with Warner's. And
well, they had the problems with studio contracts and stuff like that. But
yep.
Going back to Reagan, Reagan was also an informant for the FBI, and he caused a number of his fellow actors a lot of problems when they had to go to Washington to appear the House Un-American Activities Committee.
That was when he was the president of the Screen Actors Guild.
Yeah.
Spying for the FBI.
He was like T-34 or something like that. I'm just making that up. I mean, he could have been.
Un-American Activities.
Yep.
Hey, Dan, here's that quote.
Excuse me?
I'm sorry?
I'm...
I just looked up that quote that Dan was talking about. And he says, that, of course, is the tragic flaw in the narcotics laws, that possession of marijuana is a felony. Regardless of whether it is harmless as some believe or as evil and vicious as others believe, savage and uncompromising law is bad law, and the good and humane judge will jump at any technicality that will keep him from imposing a penalty so barbaric and so cruel. The self-righteous pillars of church and society demand that the drug traffic be stamped out and think that making possession a felony will do the trick. Their ignorance of the roots of the drug traffic is as extensive as their ignorance of the law.
Yeah.
Well, what about those
great quote
preachers trafficking in religion? You know, that's a drug. Well, more harmful than most drugs.
Well, I think most of us would agree that the meteoric rise of heroin in our society in recent years is, if you can't tie that to Afghanistan, then just call me stupid. If there isn't a tie-in between the poppy from Afghanistan and the heroin on the street.
Oh, it's absolutely a fact. By the way, Irish Dave points out that Ronald Reagan remains the only Union president ever elected president of the United States. How's that for irony?
Wow.
Remember that song
I'm working
from
a book on D&D and Fool the second time.
Bill, hold up. Okay. Jim, you were saying?
No, they had that song from Woodstock dedicated to Ronald Reagan. You know, he's a drugstore truck-driving man. He's the head of the Ku Klux Klan. When summer comes rolling around, we'll be lucky to get out of town. But what's weird about that, Woodstock was in 69, and yet basically a lot of people from that ilk ended up voting him in 80. You know?
Yeah, they did. They really did. How quickly times change.
I mean, I thought no way the Reagan would get elected in 80 at first, but then we were caught having trouble with the hostages, and then look at Cheney or whoever, making sure that they were held. You know, that wasn't gonna. There was no other. There was no way. I mean, he could run. I mean, Connor.
Well, there was some kind of deal of the Mayflower Hotel about that, between representatives of Iran and certain hopeful people who wanted to get into the White House in 1980. And, of course, the deal was made, you know, if you do this, we'll do that, so we can discredit Carter and put Reagan in the White House. That's been very, very buried very deeply. But nonetheless, it's still there. I mean, they would do anything to get him in the White House in 1980 because of the hostage situation. And unfortunately, he went in quite heavily. A lot of people voted for him. Who may have been the president at Woodstock. You know, you never can tell.
And the other thing is, a lot of people who voted for him were probably union workers, and he started the dismantling of unions with the
Patco
and traffic controllers.
Yep.
And look where we are now.
Well, it just goes to show you how deftly and how securely their plans were laid.
I think it's just how goddamn stupid the American people are. Maybe it's just me.
No, it's people who are trying to think that they're voting in the best interest of their country who have been mislaid. They're not stupid. They've just mislaid.
They've been conned.
They've been conned. You don't have to be stupid to be conned. I mean, yeah, a lot of people who are very highly intelligent can be conned. I mean, look at some of the stuff that happened with Bernie Madoff. Look at some of the stuff that happened back in the Silverado thing.
Yep.
Right, but the Bernie Madoff issue, Jim, is one in which Bernie Madoff was punished because he ripped off rich people.
Yeah, if he was ripping off poor people, it wouldn't matter.
If he was ripping off poor people, he'd be getting a medal somewhere. Jack in Shreveport points out, with regard to Ronald Reagan, had Reagan not been an FBI informant, would not his involvement with Hollywood and unions led him to be labeled as a commie? Well, the funny thing is one of the reasons that Reagan became such a rabid anti-communist was because he tried to join the Communist Party in Hollywood, and they wouldn't have him.
No, they were always complaining about him, particularly when they knew that he was invited to a party, or he and his wife were, because a lot of these people just said, oh, my God, are we going to have to listen to him run his mouth again? Because that's what he had a habit of doing. I guess after having one or two highballs, he'd get up there on the, you know, soapbox and try to expostulate all of his ideas and things of that nature. He and Nancy were not exactly welcome.
Well, and in that era, he and Jane Wyman.
Yeah. Well, Jane Wyman was right. I mean, you know, she unloaded his ass.
But at the time when he was trying to get into the into the Communist Party of in Hollywood, that's during the time that he was married to Jane Wyman. But it was, in fact, Jane Wyman who turned him toward being a hardcore right-wing, racist, bigoted, what have you. Our buddy Mark pointing out, by the way, it has not been confirmed whether he was a paid informant or not. And, by the way, thanks going out to Thomas. Thomas just pushed us up over the $100 mark for fundraising this evening. We now need only another $40 to reach fundraising for this evening and be within striking distance of what the fundraising goal would be for the month. So thank you very much, Thomas. Just because we need a little bit of a smile once in a while, we all remember Paula Deen, right?
Yeah.
And that little, that, you know, her firestorm of racist controversy.
Beats it all.
Of course, you know, with looking through our 2020 hindsight, we recognize that she might, I don't know, how does she compare on the continuum along, say, what's his doofus from Duck Doofus Dynasty? I don't know. But she's trying to resurrect her career. And this is just precious. You know, she got busted in open court and pretty much had to confess that she was a rather frequent user of that word that begins, that odious word that begins with N. Yeah. And not just in any sort of garden variety sense, as if there's a right way and wrong way to use it. I don't think there's any right way to use it.
Well, I don't think there's any right way to use the word cracker either, Bob.
Well, I'm not going to go into that, Jim. I'm going to finish the story here. But the fact of the matter is, she was using it in terms of saying, what was it? She'd like to have some little children all dressed up like in the Shirley Temple movies or some sort of something odious like that. Well, she's trying to rehabilitate her career. And she's back, and she says she feels like the word embattled or disgraced will always follow my name, which it probably should. But then, proving that she has learned not a damned thing in her time in the wilderness, so to speak, and of course it is a very wealthy wilderness she was in, she said, it's like that black football player who recently came out. He said, I just want to be known as a football player. I don't want to be known as a gay football player. I know exactly what he's saying.
Yeah, oh, for that was pretty sad.
God's sake.
Connect.
So I guess I don't know. Maybe she's going to have a new show on the Food Channel called "Cooking Gay Like Me" with Paula Deen. What?
Yeah, she wants to play gay football. What's up with that?
Embattled gay football playing Food Network star Paula Deen said today.
Is that not?
How can this help her career?
Well, at this point in time, she's just desperate to be, because, I mean, Duck Doofus Dynasty's gone down. I mean, the world has moved on, and she knows it.
Yeah. Well, can anybody tell me what she's doing to begin with?
Was she a cooking show hostess?
Oh, yeah, you know, and she made this
show, but I mean the Duck Dynasty thing.
What,
you know, the thing about the that word is that a lot of my fellow homies use it as a term of endearment.
Yeah, I know, and I'm of two minds on that, Sergi, and I guess I don't have a marker in that game, but I'd really just like for the word to go all the way away. It was June 21st, 2013. When she admitted that she'd used the word, and the real kicker was when she admitted that she had tried to cook Sambo burger.
Speaking of Sambo burgers, wasn't it a year ago, Bob? When we had the similar issue with some school doing some racist, serving something or having waiters or waitresses dressed up as slave servants, last February. I'm talking about that school with the, fried chicken or some goddamn thing. You referenced earlier tonight.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was in Talibandiana. The other one was in California. They both wanted to serve fried chicken and greens for Black History Month.
And was one of them a year ago?
No, one of them was just a couple of months ago.
Okay. Right. Yeah, they all rolled together.
They just published the menu and got caught. These folks actually served the meal courtesy of – but you know, they had no say-so in the meal being served – because they had contracted it out to be served by Aladdin Food Management Services of West Virginia.
Yeah.
And this might be a good time to remind folks that based on an analysis of Google searches, the single most racist state in the nation is, in fact, West Virginia.
Yeah.
But I love this passage from... Yes?
Is that Aladdin Food Services, is that the same company that makes the thermoses and lunch boxes? And
no,
stuff?
No, I don't think so. No, that's a okay. No. This is a food service company comes in on a truck, unloads stuff into the hospital, into the school cafeteria, that kind of thing.
Yeah, they make lamps too.
Not this Aladdin. Stop that, Jim. You're being incorrigible again. I love this passage though from Paula Deen. I mentioned that burger. She said, I'll never forget the day I was doing hamburgers, and I was cooking what ended up being called a bow burger, which was topped with a fried egg. Actually, I wanted to call it a Sambo burger. It came about when this motorcycle-driving, long-haired lawyer named Sam told me about his favorite little hamburger joint owned by a guy named Bo. When Sam was out tootling along on his cycle, he'd stop off for the best burger in town, top of the fried egg, some melted cheese, a load of grilled onions, out of this world. One day, Sam was on my set because we were doing a show about motorcycles, and we were standing around talking about these burgers, and I told him, Sam, I'm going to do that burger on the show. We'll call it after you, the Sambo Burger.
See, it's all so innocent.
I wonder if Elvis Presley ever went there.
Oh God! No, he just had the thing for the peanut butter and banana and mayonnaise on toast, Jim.
I see. I'm sorry, I never read his cookbook.
Well, peanut butter and banana on toast is pretty damn good. I happen to know a little restaurant that's been open for about 120 years in Florence, Alabama, that still moves a bunch of them.
Yeah, but not with a ton of bacon on it.
No, I don't know. Probably get bacon on it. That seems like...
That's what his was. It's called Fool's Gold. That's when he would get his group and they would fly out to some place where they would get...
I never heard about the bacon, Jim. I just heard about the mayonnaise, the peanut butter, and the bananas.
No, it had to have about a half pound of bacon on it, too.
That seems like, and maybe this is inappropriate to say under the circumstances, that seems like overkill.
Yeah, I kind of thought so, too.
No, my grandmother used to eat peanut butter, banana, and mayo, peanut butter banana is pretty good, but I used to like peanut butter, honey, and banana on toast for the V8 to wash it down.
Ooh.
V8 wash it down?
Yeah, instead of milk, you know. I was back in my vegetarian days.
Wow, that's a new one for me.
The V8 is a twist for me.
I mean, I like V8 just by itself with nothing else in it. But nonetheless, I mean, you just opened up a whole new world of
culinary delight.
Gustatory culinary or whatever you want, but they, knock yourself out.
Well, I'll tell you what I've become very fond of. I argue that the best Bloody Mary mixer in the world is a brand, and we've recently, like in the last year and a half, started getting it here in West Virginia. I first found out about it on a trip to New Orleans a couple of years back. A brand of Bloody Mary mix called Zing Zang. Z-I-N-G-Z-A-N-G, and it's out of Illinois. But I think every bar I was in New Orleans was using it for their Bloody Marys. I'm not much of a Bloody Mary guy, but I do love the Bloody Mary mix. And so I've taken to buying this stuff, and I'll cut it with just plain tomato juice. You know, about 3 parts tomato juice to 1 part Zing Zang. And I mean, it lights stuff up. Sometimes I'll get a little bit fancy and wet the rim of the glass and use a little bit of Tony Sacheri's and some celery seed. And then, oh, wow. And if you do want to get creative and pour some cheap tequila in it, it's not a bad idea.
You got to cut that down to 25%.
Stalk of celery in it too.
Well, this Zing Zang is. I mean, it's thick.
Mm.
I mean, it's made to be diluted by melting ice and whatever 80 or better proof liquor you're pouring in it, or makes a pretty damn good chelada too along the way.
Well, my regards to Mary Tudor. I mean, she did have good intentions, didn't she?
Yeah, where was the Bloody Mary invented?
Oh, Lord, I don't know. But That's the reason they called it. You have the Virgin Mary and the Bloody Mary. So, I mean, Bloody Mary, of course, somehow got it.
Doesn't have anything to do with the Mary Queen of Scots having her time of the month, huh?
No, it was Bloody Mary, the one who was Mary Tudor, who came to the power after Henry VIII died. The one who married Philip II of Spain. That's where the Bloody Mary comes from. She could be a right nasty person herself. She, like, burned 300 people in Smithfield, stuff like that. And then thought she was pregnant, but it was because of some type of thing, cancer, that she left this world, and then came Elizabeth II. But, you know, Bob, what we're talking about, food porn, there's something I wanted to ask you about pâté. Do you like pâté?
Oh, yes.
Let me give you a good recipe for pâté, okay, real quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Just chicken liver, lots of butter, and the thing that will kill that liver taste and make it real palatable is, of all things, applejack.
I'll be damned. That probably would be really good.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, I love some of the, you know, pâté is kind of a generic term. And it can be any kind of sort of molded or congealed or every now and then you'll find a country pâté on a menu, and it's a whole bunch of different chopped up meats, and it's delicious.
Well, I've just used the chicken livers and stuff like that and sauteed them and then put them in the food processor with a couple sticks of butter and then that applejack, and you can.
Well, that applejack probably does make a world of difference.
It does. It really does. It's a very good addition.
Just have it on a cracker or toast points or what, Jim?
Mm-hmm. Anything. I'll guarantee you one thing. And plus, back in the older days, after using my electronic water pipe, it sure made some good stuff.
The one with the aquarium pump and the stirrups?
Yes, yes, yes.
I'm sorry, I'm never going to forget that.
Pipe, but it wasn't like that.
Huh? Do what, Bob?
I used to have a water pipe, but not like that.
You never had to put stirrups in yours?
No.
Well, hell, I don't know what you were smoking.
You haven't lived.
You hadn't lived, because I'll tell you one thing, you think you could just hop on trigger and just go straight out the front door.
Giddy up.
Yippee-yi-yo-ki-yi-ki-yi, whatever.
Oh, by the way, I just looked this up over at Wikipedia. Some people credit George Jessel, of all people, with the invention of the Bloody Mary.
George Jessel?
Yeah.
You gotta be kidding me.
It first shows up in the gossip column by Lucius Beebe in 1939, called This New York. George Jessel's newest pick-me-up, which is receiving attention from the town's paragraphers, is called a Bloody Mary, half tomato juice, half vodka.
Well, you know, many a Sunday brunch for me, Bloody Marys, I'll tell you.
There's nothing like the hair of the dog if you've got a real bad hangover.
Well, you're talking about Sunday morning after working Friday and Saturday night, and I went into a bar on a Saturday to fix something. The barmaid who worked Friday, she said, Bill, you did a half a fifth of gin last night. Oh, really?
Oh, boy, I bet you had a head, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I finally had to quit that stuff 20 years ago, but me and Tangeray used to get along very well.
Yeah, I've had my share of it, too. Lord,
be a creative artist, that, if you had enough of it.
By the way, just to follow this to its logical conclusion, as far as the naming convention for the drink, Jim, according to the Wikipedia article, and, you know, Wikipedia, take it for what it's worth.
Yeah.
Some of the people who were around for the early days of the Bloody Mary actually said it was named after Mary Pickford.
You mean America's sweetheart?
Yes.
Oh, no. Could have been. Not over at Pick Fair. They'd never do anything like that.
Another story says it was named after a waitress named Mary who worked at a Chicago bar called the Bucket of Blood.
Man, that was a common name for bars in a lot of the ethnic neighborhoods in Cleveland.
Good Lord in heaven, how many terms have I heard that? The times have I heard that used? My God, a bucket of blood.
But even, you know, seriously, with this Zing Zang stuff, even if you forego the vodka, Irish Dave wanting to know how many parts per million.
Well, hell, why forego the vodka? If you're going to do it, go the whole way.
Well, because I can't get up every morning and just start getting loaded, Jim.
No, it just sort of smooths out the day. It gives you a little sparkle to proceed.
I try to generally wait at least until the sun's been down for a couple of hours.
Over the yard, all right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I hear you.
But I have been reading these John D. McDonald novels, and his drink of choice is a highball glass filled two-thirds of the way up with ice, in which one then pours a little bit of sherry, shakes it around, and pours it out through a strainer, and then fills the glass back up with Plymouth gin.
Ooh, wow. That's with sherry?
Yeah.
Oh, Lord. Now, I'll guarantee you one thing. If you really want to go around the world inside your head the next morning, they get loaded on sherry. I can guarantee you. That will definitely...
Oh, sherry, champagne, yeah, all of that stuff. Just no. No, thank you. Don't want a head full of any of that. Now, because this stuff often shows up literarily, another one that fascinated me, and I think this is in the posthumously published Islands in the Stream by Hemingway. He has his protagonist in at least one portion of that sitting around a bar in maybe Bimini, and he's drinking a concoction that is gin, lime juice, and coconut water.
Hmm.
You know, the liquid from the liquid from when you tap a coconut.
You know, Bob, I will never forget Fred Sanford's favorite recipe, Ripple and Champagne. He called it Shampipple.
Yeah.
Speaking of whom, and I remember your conversation with Tracy last night about Harlem Nights.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite movies. God, I love that movie. And, of course, Della Reese playing the madam and stuff like that. And she and her little problem with Eddie Murphy and... Well, somebody shot my, he shot my pinky toe. He was just wonderful in that.
And that's a wonderful movie.
And then when she goes over to the bad guy, what's his name, who's trying to take over Eddie Murphy's establishment, and with the other guy, oh Lord, bless his soul, I love him too. But that was a damn good movie, and it really was. And Red Fox, God bless him, you know, he had his own unique brand of humor. He certainly did. And every time I can see him on, there's a TV station here that carries him a lot. And every time, I never get tired of any of those characters because they were just wonderful.
Oh, let's see. It is 22 minutes past the hour. This is Friday on the Front Porch on the Horn. And by the way, Jay Cruzen came in, and Devin we heard from a few minutes ago. Good evening, Jay Cruzen. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear. Just wanted to make sure we said howdy. So.
I'm just sitting around at work right now. I'm just taking it all in at the moment.
Oh, that works. That works. Grant, you seem to be rather quiet this evening.
Just taking it all in.
That's cheating. You can't use the last guy's line.
No, actually, you know, I was kind of wondering about something. You know, we had talked about, because of the poisoning of the river in your area, what about a ballot measure or some kind of thing where you impose eminent domain on, what are they, Liberty Water or whatever they are?
Well, they're just going to be gone in a few more weeks. And
okay.
They get to pack up and leave, and everybody gets to pound sand. And besides that, we can vote on constitutional amendments in this state, but something like a referendum like that, I'm not sure if that could actually be put on the ballot, Grant.
Yeah, okay.
I don't think so.
It has to be done administratively or something like that?
It has to be done legislatively.
Okay.
The people have to vote on constitutional amendments. But everything else is left in the anything but capable hands of the legislature. Hey,
I'd sure like to see it happen, though. You know, eminent domain. I mean, if anybody's more deserving, it's this company.
Well, no, Grant, my concern is that we have spent a lot of time, and you know, these guys were egregious slime bags, but they're the same kind of egregious slime bags that the rest of the coal industry is. If I had an opportunity to put a referendum on the ballot in West Virginia, and you tell me what you think, Devin, and you too, Jim. I mean, you know, we're the three West Virginians here. Wouldn't it be far more effective to put a referendum on the ballot in West Virginia if you could get away with it, declaring that West Virginia American Waters properties have been taken by eminent domain and placed into the hands of the state? Because I think West Virginia American has shown itself more than incompetent to run a public water system.
Yeah.
I mean, they knew the water was going into their system before Governor Earl Ray Tomlin knew that poison was going into the water system. And all they did was stick some charcoal filters on the intakes, and I think we got it.
Oh.
My God.
No, you mind if I jump in on this? The charcoal filters were already in there, and they haven't changed them yet.
No, I read somewhere that they said that they had installed charcoal filters that would stop the problem. Have I got that wrong?
Well, the plant already had charcoal filters. You know, basically all your water plants have charcoal filters, and I was reading in a story, and the charcoal filters are going to be changed in like March or April, I think.
What year?
Now, wouldn't you think you would change the filters, you know, after the stuff stops coming in?
Well, in light of the fact that other water systems downstream from West Virginia didn't make any bones about shutting their systems down in toto, wouldn't that be the prudent measure? And that's the question that still runs around my head that I can't make any sense out of. And I realize there are probably some angles to this that need consideration. But if you know 10,000 gallons of poison are going into your water supply, or 1,000 gallons of poison are going into your water supply, don't you shut the damn thing down to keep the poison from entering the system?
Well, they probably did eventually, you know, shut down the intake, but, you know, that was after it had already happened.
No, they never did, Devin. They never did, because the water never stopped flowing through the entire system.
Yeah, but there's a lot of water in tanks. I mean, you know, it's not like for your tap to run, you know, they have to be pumping water down there.
That's the difficulty of what I'm trying to describe here. And maybe it's just that I don't understand the nature of the problem. Or the nature of the engineering of it. Yeah, there's water in tanks, and it has to do with gravity and blah, blah. And there's the intake off the river. But obviously they were pumping at some point because it got into the system, correct?
Yeah, I would say the pumping occurred prior to them knowing about it. You know, I seriously doubt that they were notified of this stuff being in the water until after, you know, it was on the news.
Oh, no. The timeline clearly indicates that it was before it was on the news. Because West Virginia American Water told the governor's office and you know, Homeland Security or whatever, that, you know, they could handle it. It was, you know, they were on it. And that was early in the afternoon, and then they came back around and said, no, I don't think so. And that's when they finally got around to issuing the do not use order. But okay. it would be a complicated process to shut down a system. I mean, you're thinking, because it's not just folks out there and not just schools and not just businesses that are using the water. It's hospitals. It's, you know, they have industrial customers that have to have water. But it
well, and the other thing is that, okay, they're informed on the day that, you know, it becomes an issue, you know, the day that, you know, DEP goes over and looks at it. Well, here's the thing, you know, it was leaking like that for days before that.
That's what it's beginning to look like, at which point, Devin, doesn't that become a greater problem?
It doesn't make a difference to shut it off at that point, basically, because it's already in everything.
Right, so that in itself is a tacit admission, right?
Yeah.
And by that, I'm because there are reports that people have been complaining about the smell for days. And you know, the DEP, it got bad enough that somebody started calling the DEP early in the morning, and they did not reach the DEP, anybody to take their call, until 8:30 a.m. Now, what does that say about the DEP? I mean, we can't even hire an answering service that can call the administrator or somebody who's on call and say, listen, people are, you know, it's 6 o'clock in the morning, but people are calling in a problem.
Boy.
So.
Oh, we can't have that.
Yeah, they need.
I mean, you know that would cost too much money, you know, and all that.
Those people work on flex hours.
We got to protect that budget. What was that?
Yeah.
I was making a sarcastic remark about flex hours.
Yeah, flex time.
Hey, wouldn't you think that the water outfit would have a spare set of charcoal filters on hand to maybe momentarily shut down the works, pull the contaminated filters, send them off to a lab for analysis, put in the new filters, and then fire everything back up, just so they could at least cover their asses?
I would say that their filters probably take a matter of days to change.
Uh-huh. Big deal, huh?
Yeah, you're talking about a filter that's, you know, yeah, a series of filters that are probably, you know, the size of cars and things, and usually it's just,
okay.
You know, you dump the charcoal into the thing, and then, you know, when you have to change it, you have to dig it all out and, you know, pour new in.
But I think there is a large, and maybe I'm being dense or failing to communicate, but there is a larger. There's something larger at work here. And it's either that the water had already been contaminated by a factor of days, as you suggest, Devin. And I don't think that's conspiracy theory in light of the number of people who are complaining about the smell. At least a couple of remarks I've seen saying, you know, since before Christmas.
Yeah, well, the pictures of the tank will tell you that. I mean, you know, there's no question on that. The thing is like a sponge.
And the ground underneath, and you know, because somebody had thrown sandbags on it, right? When did the sandbags get thrown? Do you see there are too many, there's too much smoke here not for there not to be a little bit of fire going on. And at some point in time, the competence of the for-profit outfit that's running the water supply has got to be called into question. Because everything has centered on January the 9th, but you just gave me a lot to think about, Devin, in terms of they pump it in, it goes through the purification process, it goes up to the gravity tanks, and then down from the gravity tanks into the system, right?
Right.
Okay. So at some point in time, if this stuff was getting in the river prior to January the 9th, they were pumping it in. It makes you, well, how often do they test the water? Every 3 weeks?
Well, they don't.
nobody really knows, Bob.
There is no testing of water.
Well, what do you mean, Devin?
That does not occur.
Yes, it does.
They don't test the water.
They do where I live. They test it every 3 months.
Every 3 months.
I mean, it's better than nothing.
Well, but if it's 3 months and the stuff's been going into the river for 2 weeks, that is nothing, Jim.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, that's what they do. I'm just thinking.
No. I mean,
everybody
but,
jump on my back.
No, I'm not jumping on your back. I was blown away. Every 3 months?
No, it's every month. It's every month. Every month. I've been told the water's tested, yeah.
And it just seems somehow that with
I don't buy it, but
it seems somehow that
okay.
With a public water supply, why are you not testing by the day?
Yeah, every day. Well, you'll have to ask the water company about that. But you know, I did have some good news to share with you people if you want to hear it, if we can get off this pollution thing.
Well, go ahead. I mean, please.
I mean, you know, there are possibilities of a way to combat AIDS by circulating the blood through a radioactive type of thing that can kill the virus. They've used this with leukemia victims for years. That's when they circulate a patient's blood supply through a mildly radioactive container, and it does appear to have promising results. Now, that's something good news to report on a Friday night, don't you think?
It is. How far along is the process?
It's being engaged. As a matter of fact, I think the Army is the one who is actually using it, and they're testing it there. Who knows? I mean, I think what they're trying to do is they're not trying to present we have a cure until they know for certain. But efforts are being undertaken to use this process in which they can perhaps kill this deadly virus, which has taken so many people.
And you're talking about HIV, Jim?
Well, there.
Do what?
Are you speaking about HIV?
Yes, AIDS.
Okay.
HIV.
We must be on the hybrid line. You're coming in very faint.
We always are. We always are, but that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to circulate the blood through radiation, and they're using the same kind of principle, I guess, that they've used with people who have acute monocytic leukemia. So it's one bright star on the horizon that we have some hope for.
Yeah.
That's all
I'm trying
to be hopeful and not incorrigible.
Yeah.
Jim?
Yes, sir.
There is an existing cure for, there is an existing cure. It's, if you get a bone marrow transplant from a person of a certain genotype.
Right.
Person who descends from the people who survived the, I think it was the Black Death.
There is one.
If you have.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, if you have that specific thing that evolved out of that, the virus can't live in you.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong here, and I'd appreciate any updates. Now, to the best of my knowledge, there is one person who has been absolutely cured, and this is one guy in Berlin, Germany.
Yes.
And
that's the one I'm talking about.
But that is incredible. I mean, you know, at least that's a crack in the wall.
Coming up. I'll be going down a little bit.
I'm sorry?
No, it's okay. I think Jim's talking to somebody else.
I'm sorry.
No worries. Go ahead, Jim.
No, but that is very hopeful. I just wish that such technology had been around 30 years ago, because there'd be so many people that I could talk to today that I can't talk to anymore.
Isn't it obvious that in certain areas of life that we need a Manhattan Project?
Yep.
to go after the goddamn problems.
I'll
we can conquer these things.
I'll agree with that, absolutely.
I'm disgusted. You know, our disease issues, microbes becoming more resistant, energy. What are we doing? Fucking around. Talking about, you know, social issues as if, you know, like, Bob, you were talking about big gay. What the fuck? These goddamn freaks. If a problem, if the problems that they create don't get a bad enough reaction, they gotta make them big goddamn problems beyond, beyond measure. Big gay? What think tank thought that up?
That is, actually, that phrase is, for the most part, an invention out of the what passes for a mind of Stanford University graduate Brian Fisher.
Yep.
The man we now refer to as Racist Bannon because of his his white helmet hair.
Yeah, and this freak is offensive to listen to on your program, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think he really created that? You don't think it came out of the halls of Big Cato?
No. But you got to understand that when it comes to the right wing religion industrial complex, they have the same kinds of money that your Cato's, CEI's, AEI's, and Heritage's do. Okay, and they do. They sit around and they think about this stuff, and they think about how to bend the biases and bigotries of their donors and their co-worshippers toward their will.
Yeah. I see sometimes the late night pleas for, just hit that Visa card and share your wealth with Jesus. You know, that fucking bullshit. It's pathetic. And obviously it works because people do. It's so damn frustrating that people are so sucked into this nonsense. I ask you, with all respect to the people that are believers, but isn't this the ultimate expression of religion?
Oh, my friend, they will labor like scholars over the pedigrees of their own intolerance, but yet every damn one of them will score right through the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah, and Jim, isn't the ultimate expression of racism and bigotry a lynching?
Yes.
Can be used that way, and it is.
I mean, you know, I'm sure if Billie Holiday were around when she stepped off that bus to use the bathroom and found that how Southern Crees bore strange fruit. Yes, absolutely. A lynching of any type.
Jim, are you in California?
I'm in West Virginia, believe it or not. I'm not too far away from our humble narrator here.
You're from South Carolina?
Yes, Camden, South Carolina.
Okay, I've been under the impression all along that you were out west.
Well, maybe my accent betrayed me. I don't know.
You sound very much southern, but I don't know. Anyway, so you're in.
Now we do have a Jim. We do have a member of the fraternity of Jim who is out west. So maybe that's our buddy Jim, who is an educator and a solar power specialist.
Yeah, and his call to you a month or two back, or maybe 3 months ago, when you expressed such exasperation about wanting to get off the grid, and he called in and he had a plan for you. That is.
Yeah, it is, and all we've got to do is figure out a way to come up with the money for it. I mean, I think I've mentioned this publicly before.
Yeah.
But it's a matter of, because I'm not fully conversant with the process, but at some point in the very near future, I would like for us to start a Kickstarter campaign. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting around making lists of what we could do for premiums and making lists of what we've got to do for getting this stuff done. Because, like, you know, there's cost of materials and then there's cost of labor.
Sure.
It is doable, but we would have to successfully prosecute a Kickstarter campaign.
And that is exactly what I was referring to 2 minutes ago when I talked about a Manhattan Project for energy. Everybody should be looking at this project. It's been, you know, it's been kicking around my brain, Bob, that your estate there in West Virginia should be converged upon by 10 or 12 guys that know how to build a roof, wire insulate, plumb, and then get you guys back where you need.
I agree, but to a larger extent, this state needs an absolute commitment from the green energy industry. Now, we've got some wind farms in this state, but those are industrial wind farms, and I have nothing against them, and I'm not going to be one of those people who sits around and hand rings over a bunch of bat ceviche at the base of a wind turbine.
Oh, right, right, right.
But we need individual real-world solutions that put solar panels on roofs and little, you know, home-scale wind turbines behind houses or on roofs.
Yeah.
So that people are generating their own energy and going into a grid, and it'll, you know, among other things, we were 14 days without electricity, and there were other people who were 3 and 4 and 5 weeks without electricity after the derecho 2 summers back. Okay.
Yep. Yeah.
If you create an integrated grid of solar and wind power, That power outage drops dramatically, I believe.
Sure.
Because each house is still generating electricity. So, you know, this, what you said, Dan, about needing a Marshall Plan, that is exactly the truth. Appalachia needs a renewable, sustainable energy Marshall Plan.
And that would be the new coal miner.
Yeah, the sun miner, the wind miner.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know,
yeah,
I don't know.
What I was referring to, Bob, was what I was referring to about your particular estate was the fact that you were out of power and you were off the air, and I was jonesing here in Syracuse. So there's some self-interest there. But
well, believe me, I was going half mad in the process, too.
Of course.
Bob, I'll never forget the night when that thing happened.
Oh, it's still out there in the archives. It's June the 29th,
uh-huh.
2013.
Uh-huh. And I was sitting here having a drink listening to you, and all of a sudden the light started to flicker. A friend called me and said, "Are you having trouble with your power?" And you said, "Oh, goddamn." And then boom. And you had every right, because I understand that really caused you a lot of problems with your appliances.
Oh, no, we still haven't recovered. The refrigerator's dead. Most of the stove's dead. The water heater's dead. The washer and dryer, dead. Too bad. Sparky was trying to jump in, yeah?
Tim wants to make a comment, I guess.
Yeah.
Messaging me.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Tim.
Yeah, speaking of water... I live in the city of Los Angeles, and the city of Los Angeles has their own public water and electricity, and they're called LADWP, Department of Water and Power, and the DWP monitors the water every day, you know, Monday through every day, including holidays and weekends, you know, the water samples, and they look for... I guess they monitor 90 regulated chemicals and bacteriological contaminants as per the requirements by state and federal law. But also, get this, there are constituents found in drinking water that are not yet regulated. Some of these unregulated constituents are monitored because they could be candidates for future regulations or are of interest to our customers.
Yeah, see, that's the precautionary principle at work, Tim. For instance... There has never been a day where West Virginia American Water monitored, at least before January the 9th, 2014, where West Virginia American Water monitored for methylchlorohexane methanol. Never.
You know, Bob, a quote from the Devil's Dictionary, precaution is truly the mother of accountability.
And Ambrose Bierce was 100% correct.
There you go.
Supposedly, we would go, you know, the city of L.A. spending all this money to have, like, civil servants monitor the water, but
we're not broke yet, and we're doing fine.
And capitalism hasn't collapsed, and the communists haven't marched. And yeah, and something else to point out. For instance, if you're on a well here in West Virginia, and you take a properly gathered scientific sample of your well water to your county health department and say, "Test my water. I want to make sure my children are safe," because ever so many wells have been ruined by the coal industry. The county health department will only test your water for bacteriological contaminants like E. coli or crypto that Jim mentioned a few minutes ago.
Cryptosporidium.
Yeah, cryptosporidium. They will not test for manganese, magnesium, aluminum, selenium, arsenic, mercury, lead. They won't test for the heavy metals. So the only way you can get an assay on your well water is to spend a small fortune getting it tested by an independent testing laboratory.
Well, the city of L.A., they test for everything. And to be honest with you, I don't drink the L.A. tap water. I wish I could, but I still don't. And they also monitor the well waters, too, because in Venice, California, they use well water for their water, and they monitor those, too.
Yeah, but they're probably all a government utility.
Yeah.
They're not privately owned yet.
No. Right, because when it's privately owned, all that water testing is contrary to the needs of the shareholders.
Yep.
By the way, I want to put out a big thanks to Roger for his help this evening. We have completed this evening's fundraising goal. And Roger actually pushed us $60 over into meeting some of the calendar driven shortfall that will be February. So we'll probably finish up the month about 420 short. So that's where we are this evening. And thank you very much to Roger and to Sylvia, and to Sal.
420.
Yeah, it just works out that way.
So it amazed me
go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, so it amazed me what happened in West Virginia, because I can't fathom the idea living in L.A. that all these chemicals are inside the water.
Well, they're in the ground too, Tim.
Yeah,
I think that. Even though there has been some rather significant coverage of this issue, not nearly enough, but there has been some, you know, thanks have to go out to people like Chris Hayes and Melissa Harris Perry and Rachel for covering this when so many aren't. There's been a little passing modicum of coverage on CNN, but next to nothing. Al Jazeera has done a magnificent job. But that still means you're reaching a relatively small segment of the population. But if you sit down, as we were doing earlier, and try to really, really wrap your head around all the questions that rise out of this, just with the water company and Freedom Industries and the Charleston 9-county area alone, your eyes begin to roll back in your head. Now, then consider that having poisoned water is absolutely nothing new at all for vast swaths of southern West Virginia. Okay, you can just go look on YouTube, Bad Water, Southern West Virginia, Bad Water Mountaintop Removal. You'll see videos of people opening their taps, and you'll see the stuff that looks like tomato soup coming out of the tap from their well. And you know, that was what happened in Prenter, West Virginia, where their water got poisoned, and Coal River Mountain Watch took it upon themselves to deliver water day after day after day in a little tiny Berlin airlift for Prenter, West Virginia, out of the back of a pickup truck to make sure that people in Prenter had clean water with which to cook and drink and maybe even bathe, because their water did look like that. So then Joe Manchin, who was then governor, comes down and does a big hoorah and a ribbon-cutting ceremony. We're going to have public city water coming to Prenter. Hallelujah, glory, praise Jesus. And then, lo and behold, January 9th, the people of Prenter are right back in the soup again because that water has been poisoned.
Jeez.
But if you think about, I mean, really, I can't express this plainly enough. Methylchlorohexane methanol is a speck, is minuscule in terms of the danger posed by the toxins that are in the water table, in the water supply of southern West Virginia. Okay? I mean, it's a list that goes on forever. And those billions of gallons of toxic waste that sit behind these earthen dams are absolutely monumental. They are monuments to toxicity. And so down in McDowell County last week, you know, heavy rains caused impoundments to overflow and poisoned creeks and so forth. And here's the other thing. Residents near the impoundment were warned, be prepared to evacuate, the dams may burst.
Hey, Bob, is there a buffer around these dams, where nobody with a camera or a video camera could get near?
Oh, these are all coal company properties.
Indeed, but I'm thinking of the dogs and the fire hoses being sticked on civil rights demonstrators in the South in the 60s.
Oh, we've had nonviolent protesters who tried to go on coal company property who have been subjected to bonds for crime allegations that don't even carry jail time, and the bonds themselves are in excess of the bonds to which accused child molesters are given.
Indeed.
I saw on the Daily Show or something, or they had a report on about how one state legislator, I forget what state it was introducing or preparing legislation to make it a crime to go to one of these companies and misrepresent yourself to find, you know.
That was Idaho. No, we talked about it here. That was another one of the ag gag bills, Jim. Hey, we got to get out of here. That once again, Friday on the Front Porch has flown by in record time.
Oh man!
I want to thank every one of you for your participation this evening. I look forward to our next one. And a nice little announcement out there. Thank you very much going out to Henry, who has taken us down to we met this day by day goals for February, but February being February, we were pulling up short, and Henry has just taken that down. After Roger did, Henry has taken it down to a deficit of $380 for the month, and that is a really, really big deal. Thank you so very much. Thanks to the Horn Malloy Skype chat group. Thanks to Sergi and Larry and Sparky and Jay Cruz and Devin, Grant. Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Greg, who was in there earlier this evening. Thanks to our telephone side group this evening, Dan and Jim and Bill, all there in the conversation. It's been a wonderful evening. Thank you all very much. Back on Moran Monday, and I have a feeling we will, as usual, as Moran Mondays are, be more than a little bit busy. Thanks go out always to all of you who help keep all of this going. It is it's the only way this continues, and we all are constantly amazed and impressed and humbled by your willingness to make sure that independent, non-commercial radio can continue in this country, in this program. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thank you very much to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net and acheact.org, acheact.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Y'all have a great weekend.